Okay. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. With that gavel, I have just convened the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. For March the 2nd, 2015, we are gathered here for the purpose of a public hearing on Senate Bill 5539, the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And before I turn to Ms. Deister to begin with opening comments, I will note for the record that Senator Monroe is excused. Ms. Deister.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, today we have the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs and their director, Cameron Smith, here to present on their budget, Senate Bill 5539. Your meeting materials are under today's date. The last item listed is the ODVA Nursing Facility Needs Assessment. It's basically a link. We copied the first few pages, which are the executive summary, and then provided a link to the rest of the report because it was so big, OLIS couldn't take the whole thing. So if you're interested in reading the whole report, there is a link there that is available. And that's a study that talks about the future of skilled nursing facility needs for veterans in the state of Oregon. Other than that, if anyone needs assistance in locating anything, here I am. The LFO presentation primer, if you will, is also on your meeting materials website with a little bit of background. So,
okay. Seeing no comments from the committee, Mr. Director, I will invite you and Ms. Brickman and anybody on Team ODVA that you want to have join you.
So good afternoon, Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. For the record, I am Cameron Smith, the Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and we also have Tamara Brickman, BAM analyst, joining us up here today. The Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, in addition to having a babyface agency director at the head of the helm, also is unfortunate to have a Marine as director. And my predecessor was an Air Force veteran who would remind me that Marine stands for muscles are required, intelligence not essential. So we bring some of our esteemed team from the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs here today to help hand up some notes if I get further afield on this presentation. Want to blast through some of these slides. It's a real honor and privilege for me to represent the department and help present on the work that we have done out of the 13-15 budget and the work that we would propose going forward into 15-17. But don't hesitate to interrupt with questions as we go.
Mr. Director, I'm going to take you at your word and interrupt right away. We have a couple of new members of our committee. Would you just refresh all of us when you took over at the agency and whose budget that was and whose budget this is?
So, Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, coming up right on two-year anniversary, so presented the last biennial budget, but wouldn't call it my own. I had been previously a policy advisor working both for Governor Kulongoski and Governor Kitzhaber, but this really is a real fresh team. Budget proposal that we're going to see here today.
Thank you. I think that's a helpful backdrop, so please proceed.
So amazingly, we are in our 70th anniversary year as a department. Stood up in the last, we have been saying nearly 70 years for so long, and now we are in our 70th year. Stood up as a department after in the final year of World War II in 1945. But what's unique is this is the first time in history that our department has been serving four generations across five major wars. One out of every 10 Oregonians is a veteran, so we have over 320,000 across the state. And not surprisingly, this is a graphic representation of our veterans population. And not surprising, most of the population is in the metro centers and largely up and down the I-5 corridor. But even in those paler, more rural communities, while the raw numbers of veterans will be much smaller in the rural communities, as a percentage, they are often going to be a quarter to a third of the population in Klamath County or out in Umatilla. So still a significant portion as a percentage of those rural communities. And across those 320,000, this is the eras of service, those four generations. We lumped together World War II and Korea, given how close those service eras were. If you had looked back just a year ago, that World War II number would have been doubled. So we're losing them at the cyclic rate and quickly losing our Korean War veterans. While we hear most often about our Iraq and Afghanistan, my generation of veterans, in the news and still overseas fighting the fight, but only 6.6% are the most recent generation. The largest percentage of our veterans are still the Vietnam era at 37.2%. About a quarter of veterans are peacetime, and then 15% Gulf War era veterans. And for this, you know, women are the fastest growing demographic of veterans at 9%, minority veterans at 8%, and we always highlight the tribal veterans served at a higher level per capita than any other group of citizens at 1%. And across that diverse group of citizens and veterans, we have aging veterans, disabled veterans, student veterans, women veterans, rural veterans, minority veterans, tribal vets, justice-involved veterans, and homeless veterans.
I might just ask the professional staff to flag those constituencies, because I think when we get deeper into your presentation, how to reach each one of those discrete constituencies, they all, I think, at least in my view, have different gravitational pulls that bring them together or, in fact, fragment them. And so I would just ask Ms. Deister to catch that, and we'll come back and talk about it later, how you are able to serve this disparate group of folks.
So we also like to highlight not just the diversity that we see across era of service and the diversity of those different underserved veterans populations, but the component of service in terms of active duty, reserve, or the Guard. So out of the most recent generation, 31,000 Oregonians that have deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan and around the world, almost 38% were members of the Oregon National Guard and reserve. And amazingly, about 10,000 troops still serving overseas in Afghanistan, and 10% of that total U.S. service member population in Afghanistan is now Oregon National Guard and Oregonians. We also highlight this doesn't capture all of the military families that are along for the ride, not serving in uniform, but no doubt serving alongside their citizen soldiers and service members. And what's unique, you know, we don't have the major military bases like a Fort Lewis up in Washington or the San Diego. So we are largely that Fort Oregon with those Oregon National Guard armories around the state. So for that diverse veterans population, a large and diverse group, we have issues just like all of our citizens, from health and wellness, economic opportunity, education, employment, housing, disability compensation and low-income pension, emergency crisis services, and transportation challenges. So we have all of the issues that most of our citizens face, but there is a sea of goodwill across all of our partners, the federal VA, the $160 billion annual budget behemoth. The National Guard is a huge partner. This isn't the outer ring of that sea of goodwill isn't any different from what we need for all citizens to thrive across all these different policy areas, but we feel like we have a larger chance or a bigger chance of actually pulling these folks together with our leadership and advocacy and our strong partnerships to move the needle on the challenges our veterans face. So when I took over 2 years ago, you know, that veterans landscape drives our strategic approach and our strategic framework. When I walked around OWVA on my first day, there's folks that have worked there for longer than I've been alive. And we've seen a significant turnover, both at the staff level and the management level, to the tune of about 40% of our agency just in the last 2 years, both trying to capture that heart and soul and the mission focus of those longtime employees of ODVA, but also bringing fresh eyes to our work. And given the breadth of our veterans population and the breadth of the issues that they face, it boggles the mind how 80-odd FTE, small agency, begins to approach that work. So we dug in with our team beginning in 2014 and then continuing today on a strategic framework. And obviously the keynotes of that is our vision, our mission, and our core values. Our vision is where we want to be and where we want to end up with those binoculars off in the distance, that our veterans and their families thrive in Oregon. More targeted, our mission, ODVA serves and honors veterans through our leadership, advocacy, and strong partnerships. And then our core values, respect, integrity, stewardship, and excellence. That in true military fashion and state government spells rise. So we will rise to the challenge of our mission and our achieving on that vision. when we look at the strategic goals, objectives, this is a 5-year strategic framework, and we handed out a copy of the more detailed strategies. But the biggest opportunity that we have is to leverage the federal VA, $160 billion annual budget. That's how we're going to target veteran services, to make sure that we serve more veterans and we serve them better. But the hard part is not everyone's eligible for VA benefits, but we know there are that broad sea of goodwill across partner organizations, whether community colleges, universities, private employers, nonprofits that are serving veterans. So we need to mobilize partnerships to make sure we leverage all resources available to veterans. Drive veteran engagement. There are more resources for veterans and their families than any other citizens that we serve. But sometimes it's who are those veterans, what are the resources, and making sure that we're connecting the two to really amplify the awareness of resources and build the Oregon Veterans brand. And then lastly, invigorate our core operations. If we're not focusing on the core programs that we do have and delivering a good return on those, we won't have that leverage to try to do the larger opportunities. So invigorating our core ops, building a better, stronger, and more durable department for future generations through our responsible, resourceful, and creative management. And we won't go into all the sub-tier strategies, but even those higher level ones on the handout in front of you, we continue to, over the next years, operationalize those strategies to make sure that we're able to actually turn them into results. Historically, our strategic framework would have more heavily focused just on those core programs, our home loan program, our skilled nursing facility, our claims and counseling. But it isn't necessarily the largest opportunity that we see across the larger strategies of targets, veteran services, the partnerships, and the awareness in driving veteran engagement.
Director Smith, go back to the mobilize for just a second. You said that not all veterans were eligible for benefits, and I presume that has to do with the status of their discharge, or what other factors would be operative there?
So, Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, we'll get to it in a little bit, but about 3 in 10 Oregon veterans tap what are largely their federal VA benefits. So on the healthcare side, returning soldiers from Iraq and Afghanistan are eligible for 5 years of healthcare service, but largely it would be income levels or your disability status, a number of criteria that would determine whether you are eligible for VA care. But we are obviously seeing a lot more citizens with healthcare needs. So how do you begin just on a targeted one in terms of suicide prevention? There's going to be options to try to drive that through the federal VA channel, but also diverse partnerships that may, when veterans aren't going through the federal VA and our core programs, how do we drive that through the nonprofit channels or other partners?
And I guess my follow-up question would be, I think of so many people who accessed the GI Bill after World War II and really helped build this country. I continue to marvel at how episodic it seems that veterans are able to access their benefits now. And I don't know whether it's a paucity of education when they leave the service about how to access those, or we have put up a lot of artificial barriers like bad service at VA hospitals, or generalized distrust in government. Why is it now that it seems accessing VA benefits or veterans benefits is so much more problematic than when people left service in World War II and ran to the GI Bill?
So, Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, a complex question that I think our strategic framework begins to try to address. But World War II, you had about 10% of the 10% of our citizens serving in World War II. So everyone had a brother or a sister or an impact within their family, and there was a broader understanding. Even during the Vietnam War, with a large draft, still a significant portion of our citizens serving in uniform. Today, less than 1% serving uniform. So a big disconnect between who's in uniform and our citizens at large that I think drives an understanding and a support network more generally about what our veterans have gone through and understood what they've gone through when they come home and try to reintegrate. But a complex question in terms of why women veterans who might have had a bad experience in the military might not raise their hand for veterans benefits. Our Vietnam veterans who didn't receive the welcome home in their own time now beginning to reengage some 40 years after their service. Fortunately, generally across our Iraq and Afghanistan generation of most recent veterans, we're seeing more sign up both on that healthcare Medicare Access GI Bill and other disability benefits than we've ever seen in the past. Some of that is large lessons learned by our Vietnam generation, and then our Vietnam veterans themselves helping catch the most recent generation.
Thank you. Okay, please continue.
So on our core programs, that strategic framework both infuses the core programs that we do and will also touch on the policy option packages that we propose in the governor's budget going forward. But for our core programs, we have those statewide veteran services in terms of that claims and counseling network, our home loan program, and then an aging veteran services program. Here's the all program expenditures. So in the orange or red, we have our general fund, a very small component of general fund proposed for $10.7 million. That's going into our claims and counseling component. The home loan program is about a $15 million other fund program. And Aging Veteran Services is now going to be about over a $65 million program. Just in the last year, bringing on a second veterans home, we'll see a doubling in that Aging Veteran Services budget from about $32, $33 to $65 million. But what we want to emphasize in this is the $15 million in home loan program isn't just the direct services to deliver on that benefit that we'll discuss, but also funds the core operations to the tune of some 40 other positions at the department, and really what would be centralized services, administration, communications, and IT, our finance team, the administrative staff, the facility and construction management, and the HR is all largely still funded off of the home loan program. We were able in previous budget to shift some of those direct statewide veteran services budget back to the general fund. Here's just the diagram, and what's amazing is 71% of our budget will be for those two veterans homes. Other fund revenues for both the Dalles and the new one that we're bringing on online. 16% for the Veterans Home Loan Program and a portion of that funding the core ops at the department, and then 13% for veteran services. But when most of you and most of our citizens are thinking of the department, they are thinking of that core veteran service function and that claims and counseling link, helping veterans navigate their benefits. So a total funds of about $92 million for the department for 2015 through 17.
For the benefit of both people listening to this, not in the hearing room, and for our new colleagues, could you explain how the counseling services are distributed throughout the state? Or I know you're going to do that a little bit later, but if you could just do it at a high level, that would be great.
So as part of this, Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, that general funded portion of 13%, just under $11 million in general fund, here's how that gets divvied up. About half of it stays with the department for statewide veteran services, and then the other 42% of that, just under $5 million, is passed through to the counties and also national service organizations. But the boots on the ground that we'll discuss later is those county veteran service officers. All the counties have it except Marion and Polk, so that county VSO function really is that boots on the ground presence for the state, helping veterans navigate their benefits. And we'll have a full discussion of that. Yes, sir.
Senator Hansel.
On slide 12, if you go back to that for just a second, on the veterans' home loans, what, just for background, I know I should know this, but what qualifies a veteran to be able to take out that loan? Is it a period of time of service or what?
So, Co-Chair Senator Hansel, an honorable discharge, and sometimes, in our definition of statutes, it is often hinged on that active duty service. But it's up to $417,000 that they can loan out at a low interest through the department. But that eligibility criteria, we can get you the specifics, but it is an honorable discharge for the veteran status.
Follow up. National Guard soldiers, are they eligible for the veterans?
And I believe they are, not always for federal VA benefits, but correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe National Guard is eligible still for our home loan program. And I'll confirm that. And the only other slice in statewide veteran services, conservatorship program, taking care of some of our most vulnerable veterans that aren't able to manage their finances, a small slice of general funds, and then also some other funds for that component. So for statewide veteran services, that large discussion, both across county VSO offices, our training and certification at the statewide level, the claims review and appeals, our conservatorship, and then educational aid and emergency assistance. So this is the system that delivers, what are largely federal VA benefits in terms of disability compensation and pension. But it is that network that we see across the state, county by county, that help veterans navigate that. But we do, while the county VSOs don't work directly for us, the department does hold the power of attorney that they are submitting the claims up to the federal VA for decision. So we do all of the training, we do all of their certification, and then we also do the quality and claims review on the claims coming through under our power of attorney. And just like Social Security has its own court system, the Veterans and VA Administration has its own Court of Appeals process. So often when a decision is not rated favorably and the veteran wants to appeal that decision, often it's harder for our rural counties and further afield counties to get to Portland Regional Office for the feds to work on those appellate cases. So our statewide folks often do the appellate work for the appeals. So our big challenge is that only 3 out of 10 Oregon veterans have accessed what are largely their federal benefits, not for lack of trying across that county and state team. Over 16,000 claims submitted, new claims in fiscal year 13 and 14 under ODVA's power of attorney, and 71,000 total claims. And that speaks to a lot of outreach and a lot of significant work on behalf of the counties. What is that return? So these in blue, we have 2013 federal VA dollars. We'll get 2014's data before you make any final decisions here in the next couple months. But this compares just 10 years ago to today, what kind of impact the federal VA dollars are having in Oregon. So today, $2.2 billion of federal VA money flows back into Oregon, somewhat incomprehensible, but half of that is cold hard cash in terms of disability compensation and pension payment, low-income pension payments, to the tune of $1.1 billion. Almost $1 billion of health care, and then $128 million in terms of GI Bill, Invoke Rehab, and educational benefits. But if we look back just a decade to those numbers in red, less than half, it would have been under $1 billion in 2003 before the latest wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So a significant investment by the feds that we are working hard to draw down for veterans and their families in Oregon. For that $1.1 billion, since it is a little incomprehensible, that works out to be about $92 million a month flowing back for almost 65,000 disabled Oregon veterans in 2013, with the annual average almost 17,000 that a disabled veteran receives back. And despite that only 3 in 10 number of veterans receiving their benefits, we are in with this metric of almost 17,000 on annual average, puts us in the top 10 for peer agencies, peer veteran at the state level, Veterans Affairs departments at the state level. We are a top 10 state, but still have such a significant opportunity to drive our work forward. So here is the comp and pen graphically represented for the state. Again, not surprising that by raw dollars, it matches that population map that we had earlier in terms of the biggest impact in dark for 90 million to 120 million in those darkest areas. But even in some of the rural counties, an astounding in Coos County, some $40 million flowing in cold hard cash of disability compensation and pension. And what's interesting, this is a per capita, so the amount of disability compensation per veteran. So you can see this is where often the metro areas and the more populous counties are lagging behind, and it is the more rural counties that are doing a deeper dive and drawing down, per veteran, drawing down much more disability compensation and pension. So when we look at the budget drivers, that veterans landscape that we talked about in terms of the demographics, both the Vietnam generation finally re-engaging and looking to access their benefits, the complexity of the injuries that we see coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, more folks surviving the battlefield thanks to modern medicine, but many coming back with more complex injuries and obviously more complex claims for disability. What drives, other than those demographics, what is driving our work is our strategic plan and our goals for those different strategies. At the same time, Secretary of State over the last year and throughout 2014 came out with a report, decided not to do a full-blown audit, but did a review that meshed very naturally with our strategic framework, and really looking at the opportunities where we can enhance partnerships with those county veteran service officers, develop clear standards, performance standards, training and reporting, expand more broadly partnerships on outreach to other fellow agencies and partners, focus on education, employment, and housing for our veterans, and then also looking at the data piece for our veterans. Other than the strategic plan and the Secretary of State review, the major budget drivers that we are trying, you know, if we get one more, you know, both out of the dollars that we currently have, and if we get one more dollar of limited general fund or other funds, we want to make sure that we're able to identify more veterans, submit more and better claims, draw down those significant federal funds, coordinate and leverage partners, and then invest in upfront preventative strategies that will reduce expensive back-end safety net services, largely general funded, at the state and the local level. So when we're looking at our policy option packages, 101 for us for general, these are the four largely general funded policy option packages within statewide veteran services that we'll review. Package 101 is largely a training, training and certification package. So we came back to the e-board, I wanna say September of last year?
May of last year,
to do, we have one training and certification officer and have one other position that we requested through the e-board. So this would be a continuation of that one position as an essential need. And what we had been messaging at the time, about 56 county VSOs around the state, and just over the last year to year and a half, we've seen a significant turnover in those county veteran service officers. So about nine have less than a year on the job, and 11 over a year but still unaccredited. Typically, we would see about 8 to 10 county veteran service officers going through our training program. So ramping up in the short term through the e-board was smart, but what we see as an ongoing basis, just with two training officers for these 56 county VSOs, we still have that ongoing need on an ongoing basis with the law changing. It takes about 18 months to get a veteran service officer fully up to speed and accredited. 40 hours of intensive that first week and then ongoing coaching throughout the next 18 months. And it's somewhat of a good problem in terms of we've seen counties hiring more county veteran service officers. So in Umatilla, we ramped up to two. Multnomah and Clackamas have also increased. So some of it's been off of new hires. Some of it's just been life changes for our veteran service officers. But it's something we view that training and certification program as a critical support down to that local county function. We've been trying to get better clarity. What's a statewide role? What's that county role? We don't want to duplicate that boots on the ground with statewide VSOs, but we want to bring that training and certification to bear to make sure they've got the support and the knowledge. And I would highlight Lincoln County for Co-Chair Gomberg, losing their longtime county VSO, but have stepped up to do a left seat and right seat that's kind of a military model to bring on the up-and-coming county VSO to make sure that it's not just losing all that expertise, especially in the rural communities. When that longtime county VSO retires, all that expertise leaves from that county. It's not embedded within their county aging or other human services world, and it is that link back to our department, but it makes it a lot easier having that right seat, left seat to over a year navigate what is a challenging transition to get a new CVSO up to speed.
Mr. Director, how many of those departures are from burnout?
So the average length of service is about 3 to 5 years, or Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, about 3 to 5 years is an average length. This is a difficult job, both on skill set of the legal eagle knowledge, taking on power of attorney and representing that claim, riding a desk and submitting those claims up, but also being that belly button in the community, going to more weekends, more nighttime events for military veterans. They are the belly button in their community, and I think burnout is a risk. risk, and speaks to having that ongoing counseling and training and link back to the department, because that expertise doesn't reside county commission by county commission or throughout the programs at the county level.
Is it an absolute requirement that a county veteran service officer have served in the military?
So, Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, it's not. And I think it's sometimes, you know, for someone, a disabled veteran that has gone through their own claims process, they may very well want to help other veterans. And sometimes it's helpful to have that distance and removed, to have a non-veteran help you advise through that process. These, you know, often challenging veterans that we see coming forward with their disabilities, and then a long and grueling process to get that claim sometimes through the federal VA. It's a frustrating process and takes the right personality and mindset and skill set. These folks are worth their weight in gold at that county level.
Thank you.
So while this is largely the majority of this $360,000 general fund ask is a continuation from that e-board request on the training position, it does also include a few reclass of existing positions to better align with our strategic framework. As we bring that clarity and distinction between statewide veteran services and the county level, we would reclass one position in our Portland claims office at the state level to move from direct VSO work into more claims review and to drive that process for our team. Out of our Salem claims, we'd reclass two veteran service officers to program analysts. Again, to begin to, you know, we would target likely around women veterans, homeless veterans, incarcerated veterans, begin at a high level at the state level to begin to better serve underserved populations, not necessarily with direct claims work that is more that county level, but bringing those best practices to bear across the counties. And then So that's three of the five reclasses, two other ones, simply different level of work from office specialist to an admin role and a PSR1 to a PSR3. And one last piece is the $90,000 that you see in other fund reduction. When we did the fund shift out of the last budget, we have since moved Veterans Home Loan out from under VSD, so this cleans up the rest of the direct service costs or direct employee costs that are on the loan program dollars and realigns those back to the general fund. For Package 102, again, largely continuing current work. So out of this body's work from the 13-15 session, we had $1 million Veterans Extended Outreach Grant Program to the tune of $1 million rolling forward that we've seen a significant return on that investment. It was a budget note in the last for our last biennial budget. And detailed that each county that has a VSO, so 34 of our counties, would get $10,000 per county. We would retain some $60,000 at the department level for those increased claims and processing through our Portland claims, and then have available $600,000 for grants out to the counties. So out of that, as we stood up that program, we had 26 requests come in. We were able to fully fund 19 of them, and they really ran the gamut in terms of funding levels, and the full list is in the appendix, but $9,000 for a smaller county on up to $74,000 for some of those grant requests. What it got invested in, often sometimes taking a part-time VSO to a full-time position, sometimes on along the paralegal model, bringing on an assistant for the team, so there were staffing issues, technology upgrades, increased outreach, and then also increased marketing. But in terms of when we've run the numbers, and it's still going to continue throughout the rest of this biennium through the beginning of or to the end of June, but what we've seen comparing quarter to quarter when we had no grant to when we had grant, an 18% increase of power of attorney. Power of attorney, when we take that on, it means it's a new claim going forward to the federal VA. So 18% increase for those counties that had the grant program. Now, being a Marine, I would take full credit for all of that 18% increase and use the promotional weight behind it, but in non-grant counties, we saw an increase of 11%. So if we're actually being more fair in terms of that 6-7% differential, running the numbers, it works out to be about 524 new power of attorneys in those grant awarded counties. And the metric that we'll discuss a little bit later, 60% of all of our claims have some decision is rated favorably in terms of there is going to be some disability compensation. So when we run those numbers and then multiply by that average rate that we're in the top 10 for, before, just in that much more tailored metric and return on investment, $5.5 million that we think are directly attributable to those increased power of attorneys and off of that $1 million investment. And we'll discuss this more generally after all of these as a package of what we want to promise and return back to the state. But it's one of the most highly leveraged opportunities to draw down more federal VA resources.
Mr. Director, if I could interrupt you, there was no bigger champion for that $1 million appropriation than Korean War veteran Representative Bob Jensen. And I hope that your agency could jot him a little note and tell him that his million turned into 5.5 and that 524 of his brothers and sisters in uniform were served. I think it would be a very meaningful gesture to him to know what the return on that investment was.
Co-Chair Johnson's members of the committee, we will, and hopefully we funded his own counties out in eastern Oregon. Other than the $1 million, we'd like to continue that program, and I think a discussion point for this committee and the legislature at large, or the full Ways and Means, a grant program is helpful to tie those strings across our state and county system, but when many of the investments are at a staffing level, if we roll this forward as a grant program, we may get herky-jerky in terms of these staffing going up and down.
That's a technical Marine term, Captain.
Yes, Co-Chair. If we pull funding away, they've hired an assistant, they've plussed up to a full-time VSO. If it's going to look like these are going to be staffing investments, we may want to try to make this part of the base allocation. We have historically passed through $3.5 million. If we want to add this to the base allocation going forward on an ongoing basis. If there are above and beyond funds that we can plus up our county VSOs, it would be still great to have that grant program to build the ties across that state and county system. This does include $313,000 of other funds currently funded off of the loan program, but direct outreach costs that are at the state level. So this is everything from our Vets News to our benefit magazines. We're trying to align those costs to make sure that as we have challenges with the home loan program, that we're not going to impact. We don't want to reduce the outreach that we're doing at the statewide level, but we want to make sure that we fund it appropriately.
Colleagues, I would just share, for those that weren't on the committee the last time, the $1 million was in no small measure, the charge was led by Representative Jensen, but it was the advocacy of the committee. There were an awful lot of symbolic gestures to acknowledge veterans, naming pieces of highway after them. But I think that where the rubber really meets the road is helping a disabled vet access the benefits that he or she was promised and earned by virtue of wearing the uniform of this country. And I would just, as we all interact with the co-chairs, commend for your consideration that finding those veterans clearly has a high return. And given the choice between symbolic gestures and helping somebody be able to keep a roof over their head is someplace that I hope the committee would be proud to go.
Thank you. So Package 103, another general funded, just under $400,000. No one wants to bring forward an IT project in light of Cover Oregon and some of the other success rates we've had. But I would emphasize we are in some significant deferred need for IT investments at the department. We are on green screens, IBM mainframes, dating back to the early 90s. It's like surfing the web with Netscape or AOL. We are paying for this in terms of staff time, but we need to make the investment. It will be, so for this investment, largely trying to bring, even within our small 80 FTE agency and small three main programs, having different silos so that when a veteran calls us, whether it's on the claim side, a home loan side, conservatorship side, we don't have one veterans contact database. So this would begin to make the investment both in SharePoint and a customer relationship management system, largely off the shelf, that are available as software as a service. And this would begin to do project analysis as well to begin to modernize the IT infrastructure at the department.
Director Smith, is it abundantly clear to you as a state agency director, and frankly I wouldn't care if you were doing veterans or any other agency function, Is it abundantly clear to you how to begin the process of talking about an IT renovation? I would make it mandatory reading that everybody has to read the after-action report on Scenic, and they have to read the after-action autopsy on cover. But is it clear to you where to go to begin this process? Do you work with the chief financial officer? Do you work with DAS and Mr. Pettit as their point on IT? Do you engage with LFO and the two IT analysts that they have there? Is it clear to you and your people how to begin the conversation?
So, Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, fortunately, we've got a good, strong leadership team and on our own team for IT. But I would say all of the above, the levels that we are talking about don't typically rise to an LFO overview in terms of those IT expertise, but it would be another one for us to bounce off of. But the reorganization that we have seen through DAS in terms of the enterprise technology, what's the S? ETS services, now falling under the CIO's office. It feels like a lot more rigor is being put to those IT projects and a lot of review going forward. This does include one FTE that would bring on an ISS 7 position to help chart out that project analysis. But these are difficult positions to recruit for the public sector. Typically, if we are hiring an IS position, it's often at the top step in order to be competitive to the private sector and get the best folks on board to be able to give us the advice moving forward with these projects.
Thank you.
So the last package 104, a little over $400,000 of general fund. Again, this speaks... we don't want to recreate wheels and recreate programs at the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, but we need to do a better job of bringing our military and veterans lens to these diverse populations and to these diverse policy areas. We're not going to develop as robust a staff as the governor's office has across all those policy areas, but we want to focus on two, so two FTE policy analyst positions, one for health and wellness and one for education and economic opportunity. When we look at the issues, whether homelessness, whether suicide, whether small business certification, whether making sure we're achieving on the educational outcomes, often it's going to be the direct programmatic control of other agencies and other partners. But if we aren't at that table and helping build the relationships and chart forward on what we bring through the federal VA and other partners, it is missed opportunities moving forward for our veterans and their families. And again,
how much actual case management do you do? As you were ticking off all those different issue areas, I know that the County Veterans Service officers and the other folks are trying to access federal benefits back into the state. But just over the weekend, for example, my office received an extremely complicated case. At the core is a veteran. But losing his home, compounding series of problems, residual PTSD that's addressed by having a menagerie of animals, bad credit. How much hands-on case management and sorting out problems for vets do you actually do versus accessing federal benefits?
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, what we're able to best capture is that case management in terms of those federal VA disability compensation benefits flowing up. But on any given day, those county VSOs are helping navigate on health care, on housing, on employment, on education resources. Out of this package 103, the Veterans Contact Database, rather than starting fresh every time a veteran calls us or one of our partners, this would be a database that we begin to be able to track those conversations ongoing to make it sure that when we are referring to a partner agency, whether it's a community action network, whether it's a nonprofit, that we can begin to measure not just, we don't want to measure the output of referrals as much as did the veteran actually get the outcome of a roof over their head or the healthcare that they were looking for. But we don't have a great way to measure what is that referral business to other partners right now.
Thank you.
And on the claim side, we've just gone in the last few years to a Vetrospect claims management process, which is leading the nation in terms of as we move to electronic claims. We can see all of the case record. When a veteran moves from one county into another county, that gets handed off seamlessly. So you can see all of the history on that claims process. This would be a similar system that we're trying to set up more on those referrals.
What's that system called?
It's a company, well, the program is called Vetrospect. About 11 states around the country have it. And it's to essentially take what is a very heavy paper-based system. We've now piloted it from counties submitting on up to the state, is all electronic at this point, until our system links to the federal system when they turn that switch. So right now at our Portland Claims Office, we still print out those claims and hand them off to the federal VA. And if you remember the federal building that moved during about 2009 to now First in Maine, but when they moved the federal VA to that federal building, the vast library of paperwork that they brought with them was actually weighing down the floors. And these, you know, the case files, the medical histories, now all of that is in a case management system that eventually will be seamless all the way up to the feds. It would be a similar coup to have that same kind of a system for more case management at the state level for referrals.
It seems abundantly obvious on its face that all of those paper files present an enormous risk if they are destroyed in some way. I'm sure all of us have run into constituent cases where people are hunting for their records that perished in a fire that consumed I don't know how many years worth of veterans' records, and trying to recreate those is almost impossible.
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, and one of the amazing, until you get that digits to digits, where the digits that the county VSOs typing in front of the veteran or their family, feeding up seamlessly through the state up to the feds, when we print out those copies of those claims, they are currently taking all of them to a centralized facility, I think in Minneapolis, scanning all of them. Again, more human error risks in terms of losing different pieces of those files. Until you get that seamless electronic claims process, it is it's a difficult system with those paper-based.
Is that system that the other 11 states have, is it available as an off-the-shelf purchase?
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, at this point it's largely very affordable, so other national service organizations have been looking at it for their own national piece. California, I think, has gone with their own program. Kind of different states have gone to different models, but this is one of the sweet spots where you're beginning to see more and more states coalesce around Vetrospect, both to drive down the costs and it's and it is available for other states to ramp up on. So again, for about $2.4 million in general fund, it also would reduce further in terms of some of this work is ongoing. About half of it, we think, is work that's going on today that we'd like to continue. And the other half is very targeted investments to identify more vets, submit more and better claims, and draw down those federal VA resources. We used to have a slide in here and in our presentations and in our agency requests up to the governor. Given how small a general fund and how much federal VA dollars comes back, it used to be a metric of $1 in general fund drives down $500-odd in federal VA or $700-odd of federal VA dollars. But I think it's a little disingenuous, because if you shut down the Department of Veterans Affairs today, that money would still flow down. It's coming down in disability compensation and those education benefits and the health care. So what we tried to do in this brief, for this current service level plus these targeted investments, what can we commit to in terms of what's the outcome that we're buying? And in it's very similar to that return on investment of the $1 million grant program. What we're, with these investments, we think we can increase power of attorneys and new claims by 5.6% a year. Works out to be about 16.8 over the life of our strategic framework for the three fiscal years through 2017. When we run that through our 60% success rate and multiply it by our average per capita benefit, we expect $90.8 million every fiscal year to be benefits coming back, direct cash benefits, if not for this work. Another way to quantify that is for every 100 additional veterans that we make a connection to outreach, that we identify, we connect with, and represent under power of attorney, we draw down $1 million of federal VA compensation. And it's important, that then continues year after year, both affecting both our rural and our urban economies. So a few targeted key performance measures. One of the budget notes, I believe, out of the last budget was to review all of our key performance measures. So this has been one of our key ones for Statewide Veteran Services. We proposed deleting it because it only focuses on the disability compensation and dollars, and again, benchmarks off the national average. Where we would like to propose going forward is both the disability and pension dollars to better capture what is that raw impact of cash coming back into veterans' wallets and bank accounts, and again, still benchmark it off of exceeding the national average. Another proposed delete, somewhat confusing metric, recovery of new federal dollars. Often when you have a lag, you know, if a veteran's appeal or a veteran's claim is in appeal, it can sometimes take 3 to 5 years to get through that appellate nature, even a regular claim taking about 9 months to get adjudicated. So often the federal dollars come back retroactively, and you'd see different spikes depending on the year. But it doesn't capture necessarily the work that our county and our state partners are doing. We'll still capture the yearly impact of those total dollars, but think a better metric is the new power of attorneys and new claims that we submit off of those going forward. This is something that we have more in our control, vice the recovery dollars was more a timing issue of when the federal VA adjudicates those decisions.
Director Smith, when a county veteran service officer is given a power of attorney, those are sweeping legal documents. Are the county veteran service officers bonded, or is there any kind of protection once a power of attorney is passed to a veteran service officer?
So, Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, it is Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs power of attorney. So it is our training and certification program that is the accreditation to make sure that they've got the capabilities to do that. But I don't believe they do have a bonded nature to it. And that legal risk and responsibility would fall both on the larger department as a whole as our power of attorney, as well as the county actions at the local level.
One other question. I'm taking you back in time, and I'm looking at the $1 million again, the outreach program. When you were speaking, it didn't hit me until just now that out of 36 counties, only 26 applied. And in looking at the distribution, some of the smallest counties got the largest awards. Was that a reflection of the paucity of services that existed prior to the $1 million or the $600,000 grant pool? Or did they just have greater need? Did they write better applications? Because it strikes me as rather strange that some of the smaller counties did as well as they did.
So co-chairs Johnson, members of the committee, a real balance both in our funding formula for the total pass-throughs to counties as well as the grant program. It is always that tension between the urban and the rural counties, wanting to serve the greatest number of veterans and get that bang for the buck, which often leads to more of a metro and urban angle. But again, as you mentioned, often where there are the largest gaps in services are in our rural communities. So a real balance and speaks to sometimes the visibility that our veteran services. Often it's in our rural communities that there is a greater understanding given that percentage of veterans in their population. You know, we've got 50,000 odd veterans in my home county of Multnomah County, but doesn't feel like a military town. By Klamath Falls with Kingsley Air Force Base and a huge contingent of active duty jet and National Guardsmen, it is very much a large employer that is recognized. So folks kind of step up in different ways to submit proposals that then we granted.
And yet, oddly, Klamath didn't apply, it appears. I wouldn't have thought about that until you pointed it out. The other thing is that it looks like Josephine County came within, you know, a few thousand bucks of Multnomah. They either must have had a whale of a proposal or there were so few services that you guys stepped in rather dramatically.
So co-chairs, members of the committee, we've got those raw dollar amounts, but it might be helpful if we come back tomorrow and give in more detailed what those projects were, more specifically county by county and some of the decision making. It was a very much a county and state partnership on that grant award committee working to balance those projects.
Thank you.
So moving on to our veteran home loan program, both origination of those loans and servicing of the loans. So this is separate, and everyone kind of knows about the federal VA loan guarantee, which often helps get veterans and their families zero down loans. through independent banks, brokers, and lenders. This is unique, one of five states that are grandfathered in to IRS tax law to be able to offer low-interest loans, below-market interest rate loans to our veterans and their families. This is the program that built our department going back to World War II. It's embedded in our, this authority is embedded in the Constitution and has built our agency. We used to be 600 strong with loan offices around the state. We've now shifted to where veterans are linking to those private mortgage brokers and lenders to be referred into our program for those low interest loans. We have two funding sources, the Qualified Veteran Mortgage Bonds, the QVMBs for shorthand, and also more flexible pre-Allman funds. The Qualified Veteran Mortgage Bonds do have some limitations. They have to be used within 25 years of discharge from the service, and then also cannot be used for refinance. Currently, our interest rate is 3.375, below market rate for a 30-year fixed rate. You can lend up to, or you can borrow up to $417,000, and it is up to four times throughout the life of the veteran. So you can't have more than one at any given time. It has to be your primary residence, but you can use this program four times out of recent legislation. If you looked back on some of the graphs, you know, over 140,000 loans at its peak, billions of dollars lent, and largely speaks to a lot of the demographics of World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. And both with demographics changing, with the housing recession and crisis a few years back, in the low interest environment that we are, and in some of the limits of how we can use our funds and who we can fund loans to. Today is only about 2,000 loans on the books, a total portfolio of $229 million. And we always emphasize these loans stay with the department and for the life of the mortgage so that we do have great flexibility in servicing these loans. You can think of the different private lenders often bundling them up and selling them off to different bidders without the, you know, always the interest of the borrower at heart. But we have a lot of flexibility. One of the great strengths of this program is for those that we lend to, when they do have a healthcare challenge or a job challenge, we can work with them to avoid foreclosure and keep them in their home. Beyond this, this is a core benefit for our veterans and their families. The other four states, Alaska, California, Texas, and Wisconsin that have them, many others would like to get grandfathered into this, both to provide this low interest loan, but it has also been a huge funding mechanism for our department. This is the program that built our headquarters. This is the program that still, it's about 11 FTE servicing this as a benefit, but helps fund those 40 other positions that are providing core services across the agency. And you can think of going from 140,000 loans on the books to 2,000. That helped drive the fund shift discussion of core veteran services out of the last biennium budget. And probably in future bienniums, we'll need to look at, can this loan program continue to fund some of those core operations of our programs? So when we are looking at the three major budget drivers, again, it's those demographics that we talked about, but it's also hugely related to the economy at large, the interest rate environment at large, and we are seeing an uptick in loan demand. So we had, I don't have the raw number, it was $58 million in loans that we lent out for calendar year 2014, and it was the second best year since 1997. If you look back just to 2008 housing crisis and 2009 and 2010, we were down to about $8 million in what we were lending out. Simply because the demand was not there with a difficult economy. So we are ramping back up and have finally begun to, you know, that runoff that we've seen from the portfolio, both demographically and because of the inability to refi as rates have gone so low. We are finally keeping up with the loans that we see leaving our portfolio. We're able to replace them. So we're going to keep on that path. We see the demand still continuing, but also hugely contingent on the interest rate environment and the economy at large. The interest rate environment, not just important for the loans that we're able to get out as a below market interest rate, but also on our loan program reserves that have built up since 1945 to be able to earn investment income off off of that to be able to offer these products. In this recession, how we've remained competitive, Wisconsin had to put their program on hold, but through creative financing, we've been able to keep it a competitive product. So when we're looking at our policy option packages for the loan program, we highlight the two previous general funded ones because they do reduce the impact on the loan program and to make sure that that stays a healthy benefit for the veterans and a healthy program. So really the two main primary ones are Package 105 and Package 106. These would be other funded off of the home loan revenues. And with that increased demand, Package 105 is for one FTE for a loan specialist, both with more complexities on compliance that we've seen out of legislation at the federal level, but also simply being able to keep up with loan program demand, bringing on one more staffer. Historically, I believe 2004, out of that previous recession in the early 2000s, and again in 2012, we had a significant reduction in staff in those other funded home loan staff. So this is, as the market comes back, beginning to build back that staff to make sure we can process loans effectively. And Package 106, again, an other funded venture for to modernize the IT infrastructure and to begin the project analysis. This won't be the total bite of the apple for the home loan system, but both on that origination and on the servicing side, beginning to invest in next generation systems. Very much, this is a business that we see a lot of different competitive products on the IT side for the private sector industry. That we'll be able to take advantage of. Currently, again, those green screen technologies, we are dependent on 30 and 35 year employees with this system encoding in their head. And as soon as they win the lottery, decide they don't want a contract back, it's going to be a trouble for us to actually meet what our significant reporting, financial reporting, tax policies, and just all of the information IT needs of the loan program. For some of our key performance measures, we've always had a loan delinquency. So this again speaks to the quality of our portfolio. We want to be below a 1.5 delinquent accounts. That's both those that are 90 days more or past 90 days delinquent or in active foreclosure. But when you compare it, I believe the conventional prime delinquency rate is in the dotted blue and then the federal VA guarantee. You can see that spike out of the housing recession, but never as broad a delinquency for our own program and speaks to the quality of the underwriting that we have. We proposed one new, beyond just making sure we don't have delinquent accounts, we want to make sure we're bringing the loan origination volume up. We set a target of $35 million, somewhat of a new normal. We didn't meet that for four previous years in 2009 through 2012. We did break that in 2013 and obviously 2014 with $58 million lent. We may need to look at that target of $35 million going forward if that's the right point, but wanting to measure the volume of loan origination that we have for the program. Any questions on home loan program?
Co-Chair Gumber.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. Director, on the home loan payments, do we accept credit cards for those payments?
So Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, from the crowd and back, it looks like we do not accept credit card payments for those.
All right, thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. So lastly, our other core program, in addition to the Veteran Services and the Home Loan Program, is what we are now calling and rebranded Aging Veteran Services. So this is the Veterans Home program that we've had for a long time. Conservatorship historically has fallen under Veteran Services, and we'll be looking to shift it under Aging Veteran Services going forward. For our veterans' homes, so somewhat confusing, our home loan program and the veterans' homes, this is our skilled nursing for aging veterans. We've had the longtime facility in the Dalles, opened up in the late 1990s, going on about 20 years, and then recently opened up our most recent facility in Lebanon. The way these are constructed, for the matching construction dollars, there's a federal grant program on skilled nursing facilities, and then often matched with that local match from the county level. So Wasco County stepped up for the one in the Dalles, and again, Linn County stepped up for this most recent one. The main primary, so about 150 beds in each of those facilities. So we just dedicated the Lebanon facility this last fall, began admitting residents this year, or end of last year, but it's been a slow ramp up simply on those that are able, the three funding mechanisms, so you can do private pay, Medicaid and Medicare, and then there's also a federal VA per diem. Those are all, the Medicaid and Medicare certification just came in recently in the last few weeks for the Lebanon Veterans Home. So we're beginning to see a ramp up in the census numbers at Lebanon. I believe we're at about 25 in Lebanon, and about 135 residents at the home in the Dalles. And that high census is an important metric for us to make sure that these facilities pencil out. No general fund going into them. They maintain a low cost to the Oregon veteran. About $158 is the average, where you compare to larger skilled nursing facilities, about $256, and national average is about $212. And what really makes these facilities pencil out is that ongoing federal per diem. So we're going through that survey process here shortly with the federal VA for Lebanon to begin to seriously ramp up all the way up to 150 residents in that facility.
Senator Hansel.
Thank you, Chair. You say aging veterans. Are veterans who are disabled but aren't old able to live in these homes?
So, co-chairs, Senator Hansel, it is primarily, these are senior citizens, largely in their late 70s and 80s. You can have that ongoing. There are often other avenues for an Iraq and Afghanistan veteran that has serious injuries that require full-time skilled nursing. There are often other ways to help serve that veteran at home and with other caregiver models. So largely what we see is more that typical long-term care, either after, you know, short stays sometimes in terms of after an accident or an injury, but often longer-term stays at the veteran's home at the end of life. So very few younger veterans, but they would certainly be eligible.
Is there an accommodation for the veteran's spouse?
So Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, so the federal VA has the flexibility to allow spouses of veterans, honorable discharge veterans, to also receive this benefit. So it's a benefit both for the veteran and or their spouse, and also, so they are eligible. The facility in Lebanon is single rooms. The facility at, in the Dalles is double rooms, but it tends to be more veterans and more male veterans from that older population, but it is also available to spouses. They limit, I believe, to about a quarter, can exceed 25% for spousal benefits to make sure that they are reserving the benefit primarily for the veteran.
And just to nuance that question further, if the veteran wants to live in the facility with their spouse,
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, I'd have to double-check whether they could share that double room or whether they would be in gender-specific rooms, but we'll get back to you. So the census at these facilities is essential. Maintaining that low cost to veterans is essential, but so are those quality metrics, which are somewhat harder to measure often, but no less important. For the facility in the Dalles, it's a gorgeous facility. If you haven't been there, overlooking the Columbia Gorge and up above the dams and the river there. But set up a more along the wing model, kind of more of the traditional institutional wing model. Lebanon recently moved to more of the small home model. So you'll have more pods and community living, single rooms built around a shared kitchen, a shared laundry, trying to create much more of that home-based environment for our veterans and their families. But even at that, what is more of a challenging facility in the Dalles and often beat up by the weather there, significant quality metrics, was a Silver Award from the National Healthcare Association, now a Gold Star Award. The only veteran home in the nation to receive that distinguished honor, and also one of only 24 skilled nursing facilities to receive the honor overall across the nation.
Colleagues, I would just share, if you have not been up there, I haven't been to the Lebanon one, but I have been to the one in the Dalles. It is a lovely facility, and as far as these places go, I would characterize it as a really happy place. I mean, it's immaculate. There's a good feeling. It has an Alzheimer's unit where particular care is paid to the residents there. It's a lovely facility.
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, thank you for that. And it's a partnership model, so very few paid state staff directly work on this program. It is a contracted operator through the Veterans Care Centers of Oregon with also a professional management team. It's really them bringing that skilled nursing expertise that we bring to that mission-based heart and soul, trying to take care of our veterans as they age. For some of the budget drivers, and I guess we can... one of the tensions in this system, you know, many of our legislators would want a veteran home in their district and in their hometown, just as many of our veterans would. We find many of our veterans come from within the immediate range of these facilities. So the Dalles, largely they're coming from, you know, less than a two-hour radius around the Dalles. Lebanon, in that center of that heart of the Willamette Valley with a lot of veterans populations. We've always kept our census high. We have a target of above 90% or above 80%, but typically we're in the 90% range. When you look at skilled nursing facilities across the state, often they're at 60% capacity. So there's an interesting tension as we both try to make sure these two facilities are financially viable, that we are also making sure that we are a small drop in the bucket of long-term care for veterans, but also bringing sometimes more about our partnership and bringing our expertise to bear for a lot of other skilled nursing facilities and a whole range of assisted living and daycare from across the continuum of care. How do we make sure, you know, so 52% of our veterans are Vietnam to World War II, 60 to 100 years old. It is not solely going to be through our skilled nursing facilities that we're able to take care of them, but still need to bring our leadership and advocacy to bear to make sure those aging vets get taken care of. When we submitted for the Lebanon Veterans Home in 2008 and finally came to dedication just last year and beginning to ramp up that census this year. So it took about 6 years to bring that facility online. We've always had two employees at each of these veterans homes, not skilled nursing experts that were liaisons, both out of that veteran service office function in terms of benefits, but also admissions liaison. We're looking at bumping them up to be program directors to bring a little bit more of the leadership to bear, both on the one assistant that works there, but also now bringing on a new aging veteran services director. We have been heavily reliant on that contract team to bring that leadership and advocacy to bear for our veterans. And we wanted to build that capacity, not to run these homes, not to bring this program within state government, but to make sure that we are bringing that care model and that mission-centered focus for our veterans. Especially now that it is, as we double our budget out of the two veterans homes to about $65 million a year, almost 66, 71% of our budget, we need to make sure that we're bringing the rigor to bear for this program to make sure it's delivering. And again, both out of our strategic plan, we need to invigorate those core ops of our veterans homes, but it's also the targeting veteran services and the partnerships and the awareness that both our strategic plan and the Secretary of State office highlighted. We can talk about the Reid report in more detail here shortly. So for the two packages for aging veteran services program, we had package 107, which was the reclass to make our program directors supervisory. And then also bringing online the Aging Veteran Services Director. So this is a position we've moved forward on in limited capacity, but asking the legislature to consider making it a permanent position going forward into the 15-17 biennium. We were fortunate to be able to recruit and draw over to our team Mary Yeager, who is the long-term care ombudsman. She has brought a vision and a mission center to that long-term care ombudsman office, not just in terms of that skilled nursing, but also the power of the volunteer model and harnessing volunteers. So we are going to help with this new position, help bring to bear to make sure that we are getting the bang for our buck on the 71% of our budget, but also how we can be a better partner with both the federal VA and the whole range of aging veteran issues that we see, from housing to mental health to economic security. So happy to take any questions on aging veteran services, or we can launch into the KPMs as well. So for what was surprising was for 70, what was a $33 million program, we never had any key performance measures. So making sure that we proposed a new one to make sure that the occupancy rate is a key metric for us to maintain. We'd like it to be always above 90% to make these things pencil out, both for quality and the low cost for veterans. You can see the Oregon average hovers in the 60 to 70% range. So 92% was for our 2013 occupancy rate. And then we want to make sure another key performance measure, those private pay rates, well below the Oregon daily average and the national average as well. Any questions on our aging veteran services? And so both of those two policy option packages are other funds, but separate and distinct from the loan program. It is off of the revenues from this business line. So we have a wealth of information in the appendix for more of the required information that was asked to be submitted. This captures the story that we wanted to tell here today. Happy to take any questions, as well as tomorrow as well, and also have some public testimony. But we really view this as our opportunity as we wind down the war in Afghanistan, as we close out this most recent generation, that we know as the war's end, that is our opportunity on the veteran services side, that our work is just beginning. And we know that every service member does not need assistance. Many of them come back and thrive on their own. But not a surprise to us that many can have impacts from their service. And when they do have those impacts and reintegrate home, making sure that we bring the best in care, resources, and support, not as a charity, but to help them thrive and to help them bring their leadership, their core values, back to bear. We've seen what they can do in the military. We know what they can do back here at home. And the gravy for all of us is that economic infusion of all of those federal VA dollars into both urban and rural Oregon. But happy to take any questions.
Colleagues, any questions of Director Smith? The one comment I would make, having heard the presentation from the agency multiple previous times, is your seeming emphasis on return for investment. And if I'm projecting that into the presentation and it's not there, please disabuse me of it. But it seems to me as though you're trying to get a much better handle on both receiving the benefits that veterans have been promised, but also measuring and quantifying those returns.
So, Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, a small businessman like Co-Chair Gomberg may flinch at a return on investment for a government program, as many others might, but it is one of the most highly leveraged opportunities that we see. And simply, we live in the universe of, we have a huge veterans population that we're trying to serve across such a huge number of diverse issue areas. When we're talking about $10 million of general fund, when we're talking about new proposals in terms of only $2.4 million, those better be the right proposals to make the biggest impact that we can have for our veterans going forward. So, you know, we haven't gone into some of the legislation that we can discuss tomorrow, but you have to be very focused in where you choose to invest those limited dollars for limited general fund investments.
You've touched on one other thing. I presume somewhere in your shop you've got somebody that's doing policy bill tracking. It would be very helpful to know what of those you're watching and what their fiscal impact could be. And also, I did want to come back to the question of the various constituencies and how you plan and at what cost and what degree of efficacy you plan to reach out to some of those, the student soldier, the aging Native American, the list goes on and on, not just in dealing with the crises, but also dealing with the opportunities.
So, Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, we can dig into some of the high-level legislation moving forward, and some of it does have larger programmatic or budget impacts. But where we see beyond these targeted investments, where we see the greatest opportunity, if there are above and beyond dollars, really focusing that investment down to the county level. When we're trying to if we can focus our statewide veterans dollars on that training and certification, on the appellate work, on the claims review work, building more statewide capacity is going to serve everyone from our women veterans to our homeless veterans to our tribal veterans. We can begin to call out and transform ourselves to have a coordinator role, to be able to share best practices, but it's not necessarily building a core always of statewide veteran service officers to then go target and compete with the counties. We need to try to raise the boats of the all of all counties if we're going to build a sustainable system.
Carrying on what you just said, I would hope that you would have some mechanism to keep some of those county veteran service officers sort of bucked up. I mean, this is hard, hard work. And I have observed firsthand in my district that some of the county veteran service officers that our military approach their assignment from the perspective of we leave nobody behind. And they get so invested in the cases that I've observed this to be a pretty stressful job. I'm just trying to figure out how you can hold them close and give them the support that they need to do what's arguably a pretty tough job.
So Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, we have one annual conference that we bring them all in, not just on that training certification, but to be able to have that unwinding and step away from the job for a few days to be able to get that broader perspective, because it is a difficult job. And I think it's our role at the State Department not to submit those claims, but to find ways that we can be value-added and support the counties and buck them up, in your words.
Colleagues, any questions for Director Smith? Ms. Dystra, you want to wrap us up for today and give us a little preview of tomorrow?
Certainly. Co-Chair Johnson and members, tomorrow we will be hearing from the Chief Financial Office. You are also scheduled for public testimony tomorrow. I would encourage you all to look at slide number 41, which is basically just sort of the list of items in the appendix. They've got information on everything from their 10% reduction options to more in-depth discussion of the Secretary of State's review. So take a look at that list of topics and see if there might be anything that generates questions for the department to answer tomorrow.
Okay. Any other comments for the good of the order? Co-Chair Gomberg, you look as no?
Good to go tomorrow.
Okay. Concluding remarks, Director?
I was complaining earlier, co-chairs, members of the committee, we need to get more veterans on this committee so we can have some more help and support.
Well, you lost your number one champion when Representative Jensen retired. If there are no other comments for the good of the order, we're adjourned. Adjourned. There are no other comments for the good of the order. We're